they're going after people and they're applying this label terrorist. And, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about my conversations with officials from Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. I've interviewed people from all of the H's that you mentioned before, because I think that's the responsible thing to do journalistically.
Yeah.
You know, it's journalistic malpractice that major publications are not regularly interviewing officials from these organizations and trying to understand their perspective and the context there. Simply talking to officials from Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah is not an endorsement of those individuals. It's called basic journalism.
Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I bring to you Jeremy Scahill of Dropsite News. Very excited to have you on the broadcast. Always an honor. You have had quite the eventful past month, I would say, with a lot of the reporting that you've done. And I'm very excited to hear your takes on Donald Trump's Middle East tour that he is conducting currently. But yes, Jeremy also wanted to offer us a gift for those of you who want to support his reporting and many other friends of the show that I routinely rely on. Go to dropsitenews.com/Hassan for 20% off, and you can support Dropsite News. Jeremy,
you know, I'm good. I'm better than you after your encounter with the customs officials.
Well, yeah, but you haven't entered the United States recently, have you?
No, I haven't. And I actually, I mean, you and I, full disclosure, you and I talked, you know, soon after that happened to you. And, you know, I had my own experience with being on the watch list for several years, actually under the Obama administration, when I was investigating Obama's drone program, and I was traveling to Somalia, Yemen, Afghanistan, elsewhere. And for several years, I was on terror watch list, which meant that every time I flew into the United States, I would get pulled aside for, you know, what they called secondary screening. And, you know, everything that you described, I had similar experiences. And this was, you know, this was under Obama, Mr. Constitutional Law Scholar. But now the stakes have changed so dramatically. One of the things that we're witnessing under Trump is, you know, obviously they're targeting people for deportation. They're going after people that are vulnerable. They're going after people also who are legal permanent residents, you know, who have green cards. And there's some people calling for going after naturalized U.S. citizens as well. But in the bigger picture, what we're witnessing is an attempt to shred constitutional protections that have existed under both Democrats and Republicans for a very, very long time, and to try to implement a system of deeming people persona non grata by presidential fiat. And so, you know, you're a high profile guy, and increasingly so. You know, you just had a profile. Well, I think it was in the fashion section, though, so it sort of doesn't count, but in a way, it does, that you just had a major profile done of you. But as you and I discussed, you know, a lot of times when I would get pulled aside for questioning, you know, I would go into a room and, you know, there would already be several people in that room. And I knew when I set foot in it that I was going to get questioned before them and I was going to get released before them. And, you know, there was one episode when I was flying from Cairo back into the United States, and I had happened to sit next to an Egyptian couple on the plane. It was a man and a woman and their three kids. And they got pulled into the same screening room that I did for interrogation. And I was sort of playing with their kids and talking to them when we were in there. And they were saying to me, you know, can you wait for us outside? And I said, yeah, of course I'm going to wait for you. And, you know, so I went up, I had my questioning there, and you know, you really shouldn't answer any of their questions outside of really basic biographical facts. I know there was some controversy about how you handled your interrogation and you know, and I saw your explanation for that. But, you know, so I had my session, and then I left and I waited, and an hour went by and 2 hours went by and 3 hours went by, and those people never came out of the airport. And so, you know, presumably they were deported. And again, this was under Obama. But, you know, we're facing a really dangerous situation. And I think it's so important that everyone speak out about it. You know, already that system of putting people on the terror watch list was rife with constitutional and civil rights abuses. You know, years ago, I obtained the top secret government rule book for putting people on that watch list. It was more than 180 pages long. And people can be placed onto a watch list because their number happened to be in the phone of someone else who happens to be communicating with someone in Yemen. you know, the standards by which you can end up on that list where you are, and it's, and it is, you're designated as being on the terror watch list, even if they don't suspect you of being at all involved in terrorism. And, you know, people may not know this, but what the position the U.S. government has taken is that you don't have constitutional rights in the airport. You know, yeah. My friend Heba Jamal, who's a Palestinian American journalist, recently wrote about her, she lives in Germany. She recently wrote about her experience flying back into Newark, where she, an American citizen, was told that she needed to unlock her phone for the authorities, and that her husband, who is not an American citizen, needed to unlock his phone under threat of immediate detention and eventual deportation. You know, and it's these are very, very serious issues. And if you think it can't come for you, you're wrong. It can come for you.
Absolutely. I have been listening to lawyers quite a bit on this about like how to potentially tackle that issue. That was my red line in that interaction. Like, I knew that as soon as they asked me to unlock my phone, that was when I was going to refuse. And it luckily never got to that. But it is an illegal gray zone. Airports are technically an illegal gray zone, I guess, which is part of the problem. And there's also the notion of material support and what constitutes for material support that they are very clearly trying to expand on, and maybe even factor in constitutionally protected speech as material support. We saw this with what Marco Rubio stated in the apprehension and false detention of Mahmoud Khalil and numerous others. And I don't really know how to combat it beyond the fact that you just you know, don't allow biometrics and say, I refuse, you can't compel me to do this, you know, and then demand legal representation, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's different categories here. You know, if it was you or it was me, you know, we can be confrontational about asserting our rights. You know, yeah. we're holders of American passports, and that puts us in a different category, certainly in the eyes of the Trump administration. You know, I mean, they're still pushing forward with attempting to deport Mahmoud Khalil. Some judges, to their credit, have recently ordered freedom for other people who are being detained in what I think is clearly an unconstitutional manner. But if you're from a vulnerable population and your immigration status is not that you hold an American passport, and you then want to get confrontational with the authorities in the airport, you're going to potentially be in a world of hurt. And that's why I think it's important for, you know, those of us who have a more secure immigration status in the United States, if we end up in this position, to really assert our rights. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's the old adage that activists are all taught. You don't talk to the cops.
Yeah.
You know, you don't talk to the cops. And, you know, they're going to tell you that you have no right to remain silent. They're going to tell you that you misunderstand the rights that you have there. It's better to take the heat on them there and just keep asserting you want to speak to a lawyer. No, you're not going to unlock your device. No, you're not going to answer questions about your opinions. You know, I was always told by lawyers, you answer the most basic factual things. Where are you coming from? What is the address that you're going to? Basic biographical information that exists on your passport. They don't have any business asking you what you think of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
They don't have any business asking you who you talk to somewhere. And quite honestly, I think it's unconstitutional that they believe that it's perfectly acceptable to tell people, I'm going to open your phone and start searching through it. But they've done that. And unfortunately, courts have sided with this system for many years, and it's getting worse.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the, in many ways, as you said, with Obama, this is the logical conclusion of the surveillance state and the expansion of the surveillance state, especially in the post 9/11 universe, like in the war on terror, and with the Democratic Party's inability or disinterest in actually scaling back these oftentimes unlawful search and seizure methods and setting precedents over and over again to allow further violations of our civil liberties and our privacy.
Yeah, I mean, there's another aspect to this too, which is, you know, I mean, if I come back into the United States, and I've never really contemplated this outside of a few specific periods when there was a lot of heat on us because of certain journalistic projects that we're doing, I'm not setting foot in a U.S. airport with data on my phone. And, you know, I may not even, you know, I mean, first of all, at a minimum, you should be completely wiping your phone clean. When you get to where you're going, you can download the data that you need. But you should not be walking in, you know, with a phone full of all of your contacts and everything to that airport. And, you know, there's some people that say strategically, I mean, you get into the weeds of this, they say, well, if you pass them an empty phone, what does that mean? So some people say, well, I'll put some photographs on the phone, but I'm not going to have any of my social media stuff. I'm not going to have my contacts on there. But at the end of the day, they're searching people's phones. They're trying to deny entry based on social media postings. They're using AI now to review everyone's history. You know, and as a journalist, and I know we're going to talk about interviews with Hamas and other, you know, other groups, but journalists shouldn't have to think like they're spies. It should be a basic constitutionally protected aspect of journalism. There's a reason why journalists are specifically mentioned, you know, that journalism and a free press is specifically mentioned in founding documents of the United States, because it's that essential to the existence of a democratic society. So
that was
when you
that
could
was
be
also
criminalized for interviewing.
Sorry. Well, one thing I wanted to mention here and stress is that there was the actionable side and there was the information gathering side that was like simply designed, in my opinion, to threaten people like myself. The first half of the interview versus the second half of the interview after he like left for, you know, 35 minutes or so. And in the second side, the actionable side was like basic questions that I've been asked by authorities in the past as well. Things like, have you offered material support to Hamas, Hezbollah, or Houthis, and things of that nature? And if obviously if your answer is yes to any of those questions, like that, you will be detained. You will be jailed because that is illegal, right? But one of the questions in that process that they asked that I thought was very strange was, have you been in contact with someone from Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Houthis? And have you interviewed someone from Hamas, Hezbollah, or the Houthis? And that right there, knowing full well that I am a member of the media, that question being asked of me in the actionable side of things means that they are, I think, trying to criminalize conducting interviews with members of like known State Department assigned terror organizations. And I feel like that's insane, because that would mean that, you know, every CNN journalist, Clarissa Ward, could go to jail. You could go to jail, potentially. And I guess even Trump could go to jail, because he just met with the HDS guy who changed his name to Ahmed Sharaa. But before, I guess he was known as Jalani, a leader who was a leader in Al-Qaeda in Syria and a leader in ISIS adjacent groups, a member of the U.S. terror watch list, like specifically himself on the U.S. terror watch list with a $10 million bounty on him. So who makes these rules up? You know,
let's fly up to like 30,000 feet and remember something, that Nelson Mandela remained on the terrorism watch list for years after he was freed from Robben Island prison and became the president of a new independent South Africa.
Yeah.
And, you know, so these designations and the use of the term terrorism has been so overused and abused to deprive it of any actual meaning. If we want to actually talk about what is terrorism in the world today, we can look no further than the Israeli actions in Gaza and in the West Bank. That is classic terrorism that Israel is engaged in. So when they say, oh, well, so-and-so is a designated terrorist, it has no actual meaning anymore, because terrorism is a term that is wielded by the powerful, often to apply a label to people that are fighting for self-determination or for liberation. It is a total abuse of the English language to apply that term to many individuals and groups that the United States and Israel apply that label to. So that's the first thing we need to recognize, and that many people have been designated as terrorists by the U.S. state who actually are freedom fighters. It's not that there aren't people on that list who have conducted acts that could be legally categorized as terrorism.
Yeah.
But they've used it so much that it actually is meaningless. And exhibit A of terrorism in the world today is the U.S. client state of Israel and its war of mass extermination against the Palestinian people.
Yeah. Also, even Luigi Mangione, when you talk about like domestic figures, like Luigi Mangione is currently being tried for being a domestic terrorist. Does this mean that we are not allowed to conduct an interview if given the opportunity with Luigi Mangione? Like, this doesn't, it just doesn't make sense. It's definitionally vague, and it's deliberate that it's vague. It's just created to deny habeas corpus to people at a time when the administration is actually trying to move the needle on removing habeas corpus in its entirety. So, and it's something that even Steve Bannon has talked about.
What they're doing in the UK, It's they're doing this in the UK now with Palestine Action activists, the people that have been targeting Elbit Systems, you know, the Israeli manufacturer of drones and other technology. They're going after people and they're applying this label terrorist. And, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about my conversations with officials from Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, you know, and I've interviewed people from all of the H's that you mentioned before, because I think that's the responsible thing to do journalistically.
Yeah.
You know, it's journalistic malpractice that major publications are not regularly interviewing officials from these organizations and trying to understand their perspective and the context there. Simply talking to officials from Hamas or Islamic Jihad or Hezbollah is not an endorsement of those individuals. It's called basic journalism. So that, I mean, that's really the first principle that we need to put on the table. It's not that CNN doesn't interview Hamas officials or the New York Times doesn't interview Hamas officials, but generally it falls into a basic pattern, which is that no matter what is happening in Gaza, no matter what's happening in the ceasefire negotiation process, you have a Hamas official interviewed by a Western journalist, and all they want to do is relitigate the events of October 7th. And often the questioning includes outright lies or falsehoods about the events of October 7th. So that's what you typically see these officials subjected to when they do agree to go on, whether it's BBC or it's CNN or, you know, other news outlets. Or in the case of the New York Times, you know, they'll conduct a lengthy interview with someone from Hamas, and then they'll just use like two sentences of it. And usually those two sentences are meant to kind of bolster the case that they're making by talking to all of their Israeli sources. So that's basically the thrust of what we get in the media. But what the U.S. learned, and what Adam Bowler, you know, who was one of Jared Kushner's college roommates, was Donald Trump's special envoy on hostages. He goes over and he meets with Hamas officials. And I actually then met with the two main Hamas officials that met with Adam Bowler. And I talked to them at length about what it was like speaking with Adam Bowler. And they said that Bowler kept telling them, "You guys are so different than I imagined, that I had been led to believe." You know, that Bowler is not, you know, a swamp creature. He's not from the consultancy class. He's not Antony Blinken, who is paid by the makers of tanks to think when he's not officially in government.
Yeah. He's simply Jared Kushner's friend.
But right. I mean, he's like Jared Kushner's beer bong buddy.
Yeah, but that,
well, I mean, that's
it's the same thing with Witkoff. Like, he's not like a brilliant tactician. He's not a guy who has been inundated with like American foreign policy attitudes like Blinken was, but he has forced Israel to make concessions that Israel seemingly never took with the previous administration due to his lack of interest in abiding by U.S. standards up until that moment. Like, sometimes that is what takes. Sometimes it is what takes to actually come to a managed resolution.
Well, I mean, also, just on a factual level, from the beginning of, you know, Netanyahu's declaration of his war of annihilation against the Palestinians of Gaza, he sought to portray Hamas as akin to ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And, you know, the fact that Hamas has never engaged in any operations outside of the territory of historic Palestine is an inconvenient fact that no one ever wants to talk about. Whatever you think of the historical methods that have been used by the Palestinian resistance since the first Palestinian Intifada, around the time when Hamas was formed, the fact is that this is a national liberation struggle that is using means of violence to try to achieve a political objective. And so if you want to talk about Hamas and its tactics or its methods, at least have your starting point be based on accuracy. Have your starting point be based on facts. And so, you know, Netanyahu went to great lengths to say that Israel is fighting for the very existence of Western civilization itself. It is complete nonsense, complete propaganda, but clearly it is believed by so many people in power in Washington. And so when that is the setup, and that's what you're told constantly, and the U.S. has this slavish devotion to the Israeli narrative, and then a kind of normie like Adam Bowler ends up in the room, he immediately starts to feel this discomfort inside of him, because he's saying, well, wait a minute, why aren't they trying to put a hood on me and film a beheading video with me? Or why aren't they talking about death to Jews? Why is it that they're pointing to a 2017 charter that says that Hamas is not going to stand in the way of a two-state resolution if it's the will of the Palestinian people. The whole mythology gets dismantled. And so Bowler has these meetings with, I'll tell you one funny thing. I spent a lot of time speaking on background with Hamas officials, and then I did some, like, you know, I recorded on the record interviews, but a lot of it was just sort of talking to them on background, trying to understand their perspective on the current negotiations, on what's happening with Trump, on Netanyahu's threats to conquer and seize all of Gaza. But, you know, it comes up at one point where they were saying, you know, the Israelis really tried to destroy Bowler after he met with us. And yeah, they did. You know, Ron Dermer and these guys lost their minds, and they were smearing him. And, you know, the first question that he's asked by Jake Tapper on CNN is basically, what was it like to sit with unrepentant anti-Semitics Semitic people who just want to murder Jews?
Let's start on these direct negotiations with Hamas. First of all, obviously controversial to directly negotiate with terrorists. How much sign-off did you get from President Trump beforehand? And this is just my personal curiosity. As a Jewish American, did you have to steel yourself before sitting down to deal with people who are definitionally anti-Semitic murderers?
That was basically the opening question from Jake Tapper, who is a major facilitator of the genocidal narrative on behalf of the Israelis. That's his main role that he's served over the past 19 months. So that's the opening question to Adam Bowler. And then he's just getting attacked. And then these Republican senators start going after him, and they want him removed. But Trump doesn't remove him. It seemed like maybe he was going to be gone. But then I'm talking to Hamas people, and they're like, you know, how come Bowler got put back into play? And I was like, well, he's one of Jared Kushner's college roommates, and he's a close friend of the Trump family. And they were like, what? They didn't know. They didn't know that Bowler had that family connection to Trump. I'm telling that story as just a vignette because it's sort of a surreal thing that played out there. And then Bowler goes not only on US TV, but on Israeli television, and he pretty accurately describes what Hamas's answer is to the question of what is your resolution to all of this. And he says Hamas is proposing a multi-year all-for-all deal with Israel, where they would have what's called an Arabic Ahudna, a long-term truce, that they would release every single Israeli captive. They would want huge numbers of Palestinian hostages released from Israeli custody. There are upwards of 10,000 Palestinians, and, you know, among them women and children, and a couple of thousand people from Gaza who were kidnapped and held hostage explicitly for the purpose of exchanging them in these exchange deals. So Bowler goes on Israeli television and U.S. television, and he's pretty accurately describing what Hamas's position is.
He even said they're not beasts. To Jake Tapper, I believe, as well, which is the worst.
Yeah, the whole thing, they're going to have horns growing out of their head. But, you know, so then the most recent thing, you know, that happens is, so the Israelis, what I was told by Hamas was that the next step in this was going to be that they were going to have a direct meeting with Steve Witkoff, who is the envoy for Donald Trump, Donald Trump's golf buddy, who's now in charge of ending the Ukraine war and dealing with the Gaza ceasefire negotiations. And so, you know, the Hamas assessment was that the Israelis, by smearing Bowler and making this big deal about it, and they were the ones that made public the fact that the U.S. had done these negotiations, that they sabotaged then this direct meeting with Witkoff. And so then what happens is March 18th comes and Israel resumes its scorched earth bombing of Gaza. And to this moment, they've killed almost 3,000 Palestinians since Israel unilaterally broke the ceasefire and resumed the terror bombings of Gaza. Today alone, more than 80 Palestinians have been killed since dawn this morning. There was a horrifying attack on yet another hospital, supposedly in the name of trying to kill Mohammed Sinwar, the most senior commander now of Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. And the Israelis will use, we're trying to kill this commander. And in the process, it's okay if we mass kill dozens of other people and burn women and children alive in tents. So Israel then goes full scorched earth. But then last weekend, out of nowhere, the sort of diplomacy intensifies, and we hear that a deal has been reached to release Edan Alexander, who is an American citizen who was in the Israeli military. You know, much of the coverage of Edan Alexander, this 20-something from New Jersey, has portrayed it as though he was at the Nova Music Festival and was just like at a rave or something and then got kidnapped by, you know, terrorists. Let's put facts on the table here. Edan Alexander, an American citizen from New Jersey, enlisted in the Israeli military. He was in the Israeli army, active duty, on October 7, 2023, when he was taken captive by Palestinian fighters at a military base that is used to constantly mow the lawn, as they say, in Gaza. And he was brought back, and Hamas and the Qassam brigades considered him not a hostage, not a civilian, but a prisoner of war. Edon Alexander was the first male soldier released since October of 2023 by the Palestinian resistance, and it came about as a result of direct negotiations by the Trump administration through mediators, Egypt and Qatar, with Hamas. This is an extraordinary, whatever anyone thinks about Trump, there are extraordinary things happening right now and happening in the Gulf. Things that never in a million years would the George Bushes or the Joe Bidens or even the Barack Obamas of the world have done. Trump not only authorizes direct negotiations with Hamas, and not only on the issue of American hostages, but a comprehensive discussion with his envoys. He also makes a deal with Ansar Allah, commonly known as the Houthis in Yemen. And what was that deal that Trump made? And this was brokered by the Sultanate of Oman. Trump makes a deal that says, if the Houthis agree to stop firing at American ships, we're going to agree to stop bombing Yemen. And, you know, my colleague Shoaib Al-Mosawa and I did a story that we understand played a role in this. We interviewed Mohammed Al-Bukhati, who is a senior figure within Ansar Allah, many weeks ago. And he told us on the record this very thing. If the Americans agree to stop bombing us, we'll agree to stop attacking American ships. By the way, they hadn't attacked a civilian cargo ship under Donald Trump at all. That was also part of the big lie. But putting that aside for a moment, the significance of this is that the U.S. made a deal that didn't include Israel. Why does that matter? Because Ansar Allah's entire reason for the maritime blockade and for launching attacks against Israel, and just a few days ago, they did a devastating attack on Ben Gurion Airport. They are regularly penetrating the much vaunted Israeli air defense systems.
Yeah.
And Ansar Allah cannot be stopped right now. They have weapons production facilities deeply embedded in the mountains. This is a tiny group of people that control part of Yemen that are
the poorest nation on the planet.
And it has almost no water to speak of. One of the poorest countries in the world. And it's not even an official government in the eyes of the United States. So what Ansar Allah has been able to do puts to shame so many Arab countries that have done nothing more than issue sort of strongly worded statements condemning what Israel is doing in Gaza. So Trump makes a deal that doesn't include Israel that says, okay, we're going to act in the U.S. now. Don't attack us. We don't attack you. But what they didn't do is say, you can't attack Israeli-linked ships anymore. What they didn't say is, you need to stop striking Tel Aviv until the siege is lifted and the genocide is halted. That's extraordinary. Trump makes this deal with them. As we speak, they're negotiating with Iran. There has been a sea change in the posture of Trump from his first administration to this one, where the point of the first administration was, let's build a coalition that hates Iran and try to normalize all of these agreements between Israel and Arab nations. And now Trump goes and he denounces neocons. He denounces the interventionists. He makes statements that are almost unheard of in the context of post-war on terror, post 9/11 American posture in the world. And, you know, I don't mean to be heaping praise on Trump. I'm just factually recognizing that there are events happening that are extraordinary right now. And at the heart of it is Trump's willingness to sort of talk to anybody. And actually, that's what journalists should be doing, too.
Yeah, so there's a couple things that I want to address here, and I want to get your opinion on, or at least stress the importance of. Given the fact that the Trump administration cutting Israel out of the ceasefire negotiations that were conducted in Oman with the Ansar Allah movement, given the outline of that ceasefire negotiation was so similar to the initial reporting that you conducted, do you feel like that played a role in the Trump administration seeing whatever demands that the Ansar Allah movement might have had, considering that they seemingly did not have any other back channel communications with them at the time? The reason why I ask this question is because I want to stress the importance once again of conducting these sorts of interviews with members that are designated as enemies of the state or terror groups and how that can, that journalism can lead to positive results overall, or results that even the American State Department might inevitably consider to be beneficial?
First of all, if you pay attention to the communications of Ansar Allah and sort of their political posture, which very few Western news outlets do, or probably even Western governments to a large extent, this has more or less been their position for a while. They haven't said, oh, we want to be in a war against the United States. As happens with Hamas, as happens with Hezbollah, there's a cartoonish portrayal of what is Ansar Allah's political agenda here. What they need to do, what powerful Western entities need to do in order to justify their bombings, their sanctions, etc., is to pretend or portray their adversaries as having no actual political objectives. Ansar Allah has a very clear political objective with what it's doing in the Red Sea and what it's doing toward Israel. They opened a solidarity front because of the Israeli genocide, and they have said that they're taking their lead from the Palestinian resistance on the ground in Gaza, and that and they have kept their word. When the Palestinians have engaged in a ceasefire or a truce with Israel, Ansar Allah lifts its blockade and respects the ceasefire. When Israel imposed a full-spectrum blockade on March 2nd, the Houthis gave Israel a 4 or 5 day warning and said, if you don't lift this, we're going to resume our blockade. And then the day came and the head of the Ansar Allah movement gave a speech and said, it's back on again. So let's not pretend they're irrational or that they don't have a political agenda or that they don't have a basis that much of the world understands for the actions that they're doing. They're doing the only thing that a tiny, disempowered country like Yemen could do, and it's remarkably effective.
Yeah.
So we were aware that this was being said by Ansar Allah and felt that this needs to be known by a wider audience of people. And so Shuaib was able to get in contact with Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, did an extensive interview, and people can read the interview, in which he says quite bluntly, I do have a message for Donald Trump. And the message is, we don't want to be in a war with you. Our objective has to do with Israel and its genocidal war against the Palestinians of Gaza. So we did hear through the grapevine that once we did it, once we published this story, that it made the way in national security circles within the Trump administration, because this was the most prominent depiction of the of a position that Ansar Allah had held for quite some time. So, you know, I definitely don't want to say, oh, we were behind this. But I think that it shows that even a relatively small independent news outlet, if you're willing to do serious journalism and you're not afraid of the labels that get thrown on you for daring to speak to the unmentionables of the world, that actually it's a public service. It's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would encourage people. I spoke to Osama Hamdan, one of the most senior officials within Hamas, who's a very interesting guy. He's been in the Hamas movement since 1992. He's a chemist by training. He speaks excellent English. He's been one of the most prominent spokespeople for Hamas since October 7th, because he happened to be based in Lebanon at the time the attacks took place, and he was holding regular press conferences. So, you know, he's basically a household name in much of the Arabic language media, but largely not known or understood in the U.S. media. And when you listen to actually his take on things and the historical context that he brings to it, you start to really understand the political evolution of Hamas, how they see Israel, what they believe are reasonable solutions to put forward. And the language of diplomacy toward Trump, I found quite interesting from Osama Hamdan. It's not that they're not critical of Trump. They're very clear. They understand this is an administration stacked with Zionists. They know who Mike Huckabee is and what it represents, that a Christian Zionist fanatic lunatic has been placed as the U.S. ambassador to Israel. They know Miriam Adelson was the top donor to Trump's campaign, and she believes in full annexation of the West Bank. And they understand that Donald Trump, for various reasons, is going to always support Israel's agenda. But they also see opportunity in the fact that Trump is different. Trump is a transactional person. Trump fancies himself untangling the mess that Joe Biden made. It's not just about Trump's business in the Middle East. It's the Trump family business in the Middle East as well, which is the context for everything we're seeing happening in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, in the United Arab Emirates. There's the Qatar jet, which has taken all of the, you know, all of the attention. And it's kind of a, you know, it's a fascinating side story to all of this. But Trump is not just doing these record-shattering weapons deals where, you know, it's going to be $1.2 trillion from the Saudis, $1.2 trillion from the Qataris, $1.2 trillion from the United Arab Emirates. The largest deal ever signed with Boeing happened today between Qatar Airways and Boeing. It's also that Trump is setting up his family business. They're already deeply immersed in the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You know, they already have that business. So what is the opportunity for the Palestinians here? It's kind of sick that this is the possibility, Hassan, but the possibility here is that Netanyahu's war, his genocidal, bloodthirsty war of annihilation, is messing with Trump's business, you know, in the broader Middle East.
Yeah.
They almost didn't talk about Gaza at all in Saudi Arabia. Mohammed bin Salman made, you know, one comment about how we should, you know, apply the Arab Peace Initiative and we need to bring an end to the war in Gaza. Trump basically said almost nothing about Gaza when he was there. They didn't really want it to be the issue.
Or the only thing that Trump up was that they were being backed by, I mean, it was mostly anti-Iran. Their angle on Gaza is mostly still like anti-Iran. They talk about Hamas as being like an Iranian-backed form of militancy.
Yeah.
And he said that, you know, they were a child killer or something when talking about like how this fundamentalist country is like backing them. And that was pretty much it. And there is the depravity of Gulf nation leadership, if we're being real and if we're being honest, in terms of refusing to apply more pressure points to the Trump administration or even like offering bribes to the Trump administration in the exact same way that Israel does in an effort to continue the flow of weapons into Israel that end up being used against children in the Gaza Strip.
I mean, you look at the glitz and the glamour and the fetting of Trump and you know, you have Elon Musk and all of these tech executives coming in there, and Trump is marveling at the marble and talking about how phenomenal the materials are, and the actual backdrop for this is children being burned alive in tents. Children being burned alive in tents with American weapons. Children being burned alive in tents with American weapons and total silence from the Mohammed bin Salmans of the world, who yes. himself is a total butcher for what he did to the people of Yemen. This was a cacophony, a conference of butchers and enablers of genocide, either through the facilitation Trump does by giving the weapons and the political support to Netanyahu, or by the shameful silence of all of these Arab rulers. They spend all day celebrating Trump, worshiping him at his feet. Oh, Trump, people are going to name their kids after Trump now in these Gulf nations. Have they no shame when they then look at the screens, when they go back to their offices or their palaces and watch what's happening in Gaza? The backdrop to this is burning, incinerating children and women, and targeting tents with so-called suicide drones, and bombing hospitals, and killing Hassan Slaya, one of the best journalists in Gaza, as he was receiving treatment in a burn unit where he had multiple fingers amputated because Israel tried to assassinate him by bombing a tent on April 7th. Yeah. That's the backdrop to everything that we're seeing. So I can talk about what is extraordinary about what Trump's doing, but let's never forget the moral question here. And that is that the charade we are watching, where the wealthy and powerful of the world gather together to fluff each other, pat each other on the back, sign their big weapons deals, talk about a new vision for the Middle East, while simultaneously facilitating the incineration of Palestinian children, that should be the headline on all of this. That's the thing that actually matters the most.
Absolutely. So this is actually what I wanted to talk about. Like I wanted to maybe speculate a little bit about where this deal may head. Now, you have gotten great insight from Hamas leadership on this matter with your interviews. I read the Osama Hamdan one on stream. It was fantastic. I've seen pieces. I've read parts of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad interview that you conducted as well, where they said, look, like trying to actively demilitarize the Palestinian resistance or Palestinian militancy is not going to yield the results that Israel wants out of this, because there's always going to be resistance as long as the apartheid exists, which is, of course, a perfectly reasonable and perfectly understandable position to take. But having said that, Israel is a belligerent actor. It's a belligerent occupier in the legal sense, and illegally engaging in this act of genocide, this ethnic cleansing campaign. But outside of that, Israel's a very entitled actor in the global stage as well. And it seems like whenever Israel feels betrayed or whenever Israel feels unsafe or angry, I feel like the Palestinian population is punished the most. They are significantly more restrained when it comes to their retaliation to Iran, for example, or even as opposed to their retaliation in southern Lebanon, which was obviously not as restrained as Iran, but significantly more restrained in comparison to Gaza. And it's obvious that incurring penalties for their actions is what is the only lesson Israel responds to, is the only language Israel responds to. Having said all of that, their actions that amounted to 100 people being killed, including bombing multiple hospitals at this point, and their open and deliberate targeting of Hassan, the journalist that you were talking about, and assassinating him, and even assassinating a 12-year-old survivor of the medical worker assassination that Israel had conducted. All of this happening in the last 48 hours, I think, is because Israel is angry and frustrated that by the conclusion of this Trump trip into the Middle East, that Trump may end up forcing them to stop this genocide, or at least like have a more reasonable conclusion than what Israel's demands are, which is complete ethnic cleansing, hostages being secondary, not even like the extraction of hostages not even being a main focus now admitted by Benjamin Netanyahu. For all of these reasons, do you believe that the Trump administration, especially considering what Israel did after the Edon Alexander release, the prisoner of war release, for only a demonstration of good faith by Hamas and Israel's retaliation in the process, do you believe that the Trump administration is actually going to push for a long-term reasonable conclusion here, or do you think that it's going to turn into the previous ceasefire negotiation where eventually, with enough pressure from Israeli envoys, Steve Witkoff will mold the existing ceasefire structure to one that suits the Israeli narrative, and we just put Gaza on the back burner once again as Israel continues its ethnic cleansing campaign?
I mean, this is you raised a lot of questions here, and there's one, you know, one central thing you're asking me, which is to sort of speculate or give an educated guess, which I'm not in the business of doing, but I won't. I will share with you some thoughts based on all the things you put on the table there. I think the most likely scenario in the short term, first of all, there always is the possibility that Trump decides, I'm going to let it keep burning for another period. Like I created enough momentum around this and discussion, and I had Bowler and Witkoff in Qatar, and oh, Hamas is being obstructionist and they're not agreeing. And that may even be the most likely thing, that Israel just continues forward with its scorched earth bombing. And then they try to pull off this, you know, so-called humanitarian aid program that Trump and Netanyahu have been kicking around that involves American mercenaries and, you know, a fake sort of foundation that's being created. And, you know, Netanyahu is saying that they're already issuing, you know, more forced displacement orders, including in the area around El Shifa Hospital tonight. And, you know, which anytime Israel does this, it's followed by horrifying bombings. What may be the most likely scenario is not much happens, that Netanyahu then intensifies the attacks further. They try to push hundreds of thousands of Palestinians once again, cram them into an ever-shrinking killing cage in the south, put this dystopic, quote-unquote, aid distribution plan in place that has no tie whatsoever to a ceasefire, and you just have a continuation of the war of annihilation for another several weeks, several months, until there's some momentum or some reason why Trump gets interested in this again. That could happen. What I think is, you know, also possible is that we're not going to have a comprehensive deal emerge out of the discussions happening right now in Qatar. But you might have Israel having to concede to create a longer period of a short-term truce. And also Hamas will not agree to a short-term truce. They were very clear with me about this.
Yeah.
Unless it has a path to a framework that has clearly defined terms for ending the war and a full withdrawal of Israeli forces.
Yeah.
So Hamas actually has shown quite a bit of flexibility on a number of issues, but they've said that they have a couple of red lines. One is no more short-term truces, no more captives being exchanged, unless there is a guarantee by the United States, Qatar, and Egypt that this leads back to a framework like the original January deal that says at a certain point, Israeli forces are all out of Gaza and the war comes to an end, and then Gaza can go through reconstruction with Palestinians in Gaza. not with Palestinian ship to Somaliland or whatever fantasies Netanyahu is thinking about. It's possible that we're going to see something that is not great, but does pause the genocide. And maybe instead of it being 40 days, it's going to be 70 days or 90 days. And then the scramble will become, how do you now prevent Netanyahu from just doing what he said he's going to do, which is, even if we sign an agreement, I'm going to go back in when that agreement is done and burn Gaza back to the ground again and again and again and keep pummeling an already dead body. And, you know, they're bombing. Look what they're bombing. They're bombing places they've bombed.
Yeah.
They're bombing people in tents. Their Israeli reporting today indicated that of the almost 3,000 people that are confirmed to have been killed since March 18th, these are civilians, uninvolved combatants. It's even by Israeli media standards that the IDF is indicating this. So, you know, we're witnessing something so unspeakable, Hassan, so unspeakable in the world right now that we all should be ashamed that this isn't what we're consumed with every waking moment. So maybe there is going to be some deal. Maybe Trump's pressure is going to be saying to Netanyahu, you are going to concede on these two issues, and we're going to kick this issue of Hamas disarmament down the road that you keep insisting on. Because the other point that Hamas makes is they're not just trying to take Hamas's weapons. They know that there's been a massive degradation of the weapons in the hands of the resistance. And yeah. Let me remind people, I mean, this, you have a smart audience, but let me remind people, most of the weapons used by the Palestinian resistance are manufactured in Gaza. They're making their own bullets. They're making their own sniper rifles. They're making their own grenades. They're making their own rockets. You know, the October 7th attacks were
under a complete embargo, mind you,
Right, under a complete embargo. And one of the spectacular, and I mean this in a kind of historical context, aspects of Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was that it was done with technology that was domestic within Gaza. Overwhelmingly, the weapons that were used in the single most devastating attack against Israel since the 1948 Nakba, which, by the way, we're now recognizing Nakba Day, the creation of the State of Israel and the beginning of the campaign of mass expulsion and extermination of the Palestinians. You know, when we talk about Hamas disarmament, Israel knows that this is an outrageous issue to raise, that they're putting Hamas in a position of then pretending that they're saying, well, we're not going to put down our guns. Hamas is, in fact, saying we're not going to put down our guns, but they're not saying it as like the Hamas militia. What Hamas's point is, every point in history when the Palestinians have agreed to any form of disarmament, it's followed by them getting slaughtered by the Israelis. And by the way, Netanyahu's not just saying Qassam Brigades and Saraya al-Quds, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad, that they have to put down their weapons. Netanyahu is insisting on a demilitarization of the entire Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
That is the end of the Palestinian liberation struggle if there is demilitarization of the Palestinian resistance. You know, whatever anyone thinks about Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the issue of the right to armed resistance against Israel remains one of the most popular issues in all public opinion polls across the Palestinian spectrum. So he says, you must disarm and Hamas must leave Gaza. Okay, Hamas says, look, we don't need to be the government in Gaza. In fact, I've had multiple Hamas officials say to me, it is an albatross around our neck that we're the government. These guys were elected in 2006, and then there haven't been elections since then. And you've got crooked old Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who has single-digit popularity ratings, who's widely viewed as a collaborator with Israel.
Yeah, firmly a part of the Israeli security apparatus, and also the second
And he puts in a deputy.
Yeah, and the second least popular entity in the region, according to the Palestinians, after Israel, like very close in its unpopularity to Israel.
And remember, as Gaza is burning, the war against the Palestinians of the West Bank has been escalating, not just from armed settlers backed and facilitated by the Israeli state, but also the Palestinian Authority security forces cleared the way, attacking Palestinian resistance forces for then an Israeli invasion, the most significant forced displacement campaign since 1967 has been underway in the occupied West Bank, and it was aided and abetted by Mahmoud Abbas. So what is happening in Gaza is that Hamas has been the government for two decades, and people were fed up with basic governance in Gaza even before October 7th. You know, one Hamas official said to me lately, you know, can you imagine what happens in our society when we don't meet payroll? When we don't pay people on time, when the trash is piling up, Palestinians are the same as everybody in the world. You know, most people are not generally too happy with their government. So from their perspective, they're saying we don't need to be the government. But what's going to happen is that Israel has painted Hamas with such a broad brush, and the U.S. has bought this line, hook, line, and sinker, and so has much of the Western press, that at the end of the day, when you say we're getting rid of Hamas, it's the same level of brilliance that existed when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney invaded Iraq and did their de-Ba'athification program. When you fire all of the civil servants because they happen to have been affiliated with the former government's political party or the single party system that existed in Iraq, that means you're firing the teachers, you're firing the postal workers, you're firing the doctors in many cases, you're firing the people that are the paper pushers that nobody ever thanks or sees what they do. That's what we're talking about here. So Hamas is saying, okay, put anybody in who you think is going to be competent. But at the end of the day, you're going to come and ask us because we've been the only government there since 2006.
Yeah.
So speaking of George W. Bush, also is a red herring.
Speaking of George W. Bush, ironically enough, that election was conducted against the wishes of the Palestinian Authority in 2006, which understood how unpopular they had become due to their consistent collaboration with the Israeli state and due to the failures of the ceasefire, the so-called peace talks with Israel, and what that had yielded for the Palestinians in the West Bank, which was Bantustans forming due to settlements propping up all over the West Bank. And that was a Bush gift as well to force an election in all of historic occupied Palestine, which, of course, Hamas was seen as a anti-corruption party, which led them to win over the Palestinian Authority and Fatah.
I mean, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because remember that Ismail Haniyeh, who was assassinated last summer in Tehran, Iran, who was the political leader of Hamas for a very, very long time, was supposed to be the prime minister of Palestine. And there was a civil war between Hamas and Fatah, and Hamas consolidated its control of Gaza. International sanctions,
right? American facilitated coup d'etat.
Yeah. Right. And the United States and other Western countries decided very swiftly that an election that actually Jimmy Carter, had observers on the ground for, that the wrong people won the free and fair election. And so we're going to punish them. We're going to collectively punish them. So that's when they implement this sweeping blockade around Gaza. They start the policy of intense collective punishment. And, you know, Hamas had been criticized by some other resistance factions for standing in those elections. You know, for instance, Palestinian Islamic Jihad has taken a position, and I've twice interviewed the number two figure in Palestinian Islamic Jihad, who's actually a pediatrician by training, Dr. Mohammed Al-Hindi. And, you know, Palestinian Islamic Jihad will not participate in elections organized by what it considers to be an illegitimate entity, which is the Palestinian Authority, but they are very much a part of the body politic, the fabric of Palestinian society. And another more basic point, Hassan, that seldom goes unmentioned, Hamas is not some foreign entity that descended on Gaza one day. These are people of the community. The men who are in the Qassam brigades or in Saraya al-Quds are fathers and sons and daughters and brothers of Palestinian families. And, you know, Osama Hamdan shared with me, you know, he's a senior official in Hamas. He was telling me just about his relatives. You know, some are in Fatah, some are in PFLP, you know, some are not in any political affiliation. And he was just talking about how there's such a cartoonish way in which Palestinians are talked about. And he's like, ask me, do you have relatives that voted for Trump? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, why aren't Palestinians allowed to have that complexity in our family lives either? You know, it's a good question. And it's a fair question that he asked me. So, you know, when we talk about this, there is an internal Palestinian dialogue about what Hamas is, whether people, you know, want them to be the government, and that's for Palestinians to decide. But what we're watching is a lie-filled narrative that distorts facts, that necessitates a portrayal of Hamas as being so beyond the pale, akin to Al-Qaeda and ISIS, that the only solution then is to mass murder everyone.
Yeah.
So when Israel says Hamas must leave Gaza, what does that mean? That you're talking about potentially then the families of everybody has to go? What does it mean to expel? These are not serious ideas that Netanyahu is putting up. These are ideas intended to justify the forced mass expulsion or murder of every Palestinian in Gaza. If Hamas was to say, we will agree to demilitarize the Gaza Strip, they would essentially be surrendering on behalf of 76 years of Palestinian history and people. And it's why the most recent public opinion polling of Palestinians in both Gaza and the West Bank has shown that most Palestinians support Hamas's position in the negotiations on issues such as disarmament or issues such as surrendering to the Israelis or making a deal to release the captives without a firm deal to end the genocide.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned this already, but like Hamas is or the Al-Qassam brigades are almost entirely comprised of orphaned soldiers. Like the reality of the matter is, as long as Israel keeps killing the Palestinian population, there will always be an understandable moral obligation and a legal one to resist against such actions from the indigenous population. This is a reality that Israeli military officials have recognized. This is a reality that former Israeli prime ministers have recognized. This is a reality that Shin Bet officials have recognized as well. They have a legal right to resist against this unjustifiable occupation that is conducting a genocide right now. And I think going back to the importance of your journalism, the importance of journalism in general that seeks out the truth by talking to the groups that are considered terrorists by the state, I wanted to juxtapose your work with the way that the current mainstream press and legacy media operates, where I think they play a formative role in trying to get Americans to consistently refuse their better judgment when they see dead children on their timeline, on their social media feeds, or all of the pain that Palestinians are subjected to, by trying to create this like unworkable position where some Americans will recognize that there is a genocide going on and it's heinous, but also simultaneously say, well, any kind of group resisting against said genocide is actually wrong still, and that you shouldn't even talk to them. And that the discussion should never revolve around them behaving as rational actors, regardless of tactics, rational actors with an overarching desirable goal to end this occupation and to end this genocide. And yeah, that is something that you alluded to in the beginning when you talked about like how Western press will often immediately demand Hamas condemn its own campaigns or its own operations or itself. And I feel like this is thought terminating, and it's somewhat successful. That's why you arrive at people that on the one hand will say, yeah, what Israel's doing is really messed up. But you know who's really also messed up? Hamas.
You know, this is the whole history of armed resistance against established power or against colonialism or against apartheid, that you must portray anyone who uses armed force to try to overthrow your system of oppression is a terrorist. This is also the way that Black Americans who rebelled by force of arms against slavery were characterized at the time. It's how indigenous people in the United States were characterized by European settler colonialists who began to expand their occupation of native lands in the United States. It's a story as old as war itself. And so when I look at the history of Palestinian resistance, you look at the evolution of thinking, the evolution of tactics. You know, Hamas and Islamic Jihad are relatively new to the Palestinian resistance scene because this has been going on for so long, for so many decades. And, you know, large chunks of the story of Palestinian resistance involve secular-oriented Palestinian nationalists or yeah, liberation fighters. And part of what happened is that, you know, Hamas and Islamic Jihad started to rise up out of a period where Israel had expelled and exiled all of these Palestinian resistance figures, including people like Dr. Mohammed Al-Hindi, who I've interviewed from Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And they kind of put them all in the same place in the camps in Lebanon. And you know, it was a heady time like in the Islamic world. Well, then there's also that component, which is that yeah, they're constantly assassinating any Palestinian that rises up and has an ability to be a uniter of the Palestinian cause. It's why Marwan Barghouti continues to rot in a prison cell, because the Israelis fear that that figure, who is not from Hamas, he's actually from Fatah, but he's number one on Hamas's list of prisoners that they want freed yeah, in these exchanges, and has been from the very beginning. That terrifies Israel, and that's why Israel assassinates and imprisons Palestinians that it believes pose a threat to its colonial apartheid occupation regime. But the story of Palestinian resistance is not one of terrorism. It's one of justifiable armed insurrection against a settler colonial state. And there are chapters in that story that you can talk about and say, well, what about blowing yourself up on a bus full of civilians? You can have debates about those tactics. And, you know, right now is not the time to do that. But certainly those are relevant discussions to have. But I'm sorry, that's one tree in the forest. The forest is a story of a people who were punished because of Germany's mass murder of Jews and other minorities in Europe. And Western powers decided that they were going to steal the land from the Palestinians and impose a European colonial settler state on that territory. And then they were going to say, we're going to demonize anyone who was indigenous to the land that dares to challenge what we've just done to them. That's what the British did to the Irish. That's what the settlers did to the indigenous Native American population. That is the story of colonialism and the story of armed resistance. This is an epic lie that has been told over these past 19 months and these past 77 years. An epic lie has been told about the motivations and political objectives of the Palestinian resistance. Their objective is self-determination. Their objective is to expel occupiers. Their objective is to achieve the same rights of any people on this planet. That's their objective. You can debate tactics. That's fine. That's legitimate. But let's not pretend that that is the story. The story is the genocidal regime that is mass murdering Palestinians right now because they've had the audacity to commit an act of resistance, which as a Palestinian means you've taken a breath on planet Earth. You've dared to live.
Yeah. Also, one important part of this conversation, actually, because we talked about the vague definitions of terrorism, is the historic usage of terrorism most commonly is talked about with respect to the war on terror, the anti-Muslim thrust of war on terror policies. But that was built on top of a pre-existing foundation, and its inception point is the Palestinian liberation struggle, as a matter of fact. The earliest mention of terrorism in a federal statute was in 1969, and it dealt specifically with restricting humanitarian aid to Palestinians and inaugurated a pattern of rendering Palestinians synonymous with terrorism. So as early as 1969 was the first mention of this term in the American legal setting, and it was directed towards Palestinian liberation organizations. So it has been going on for quite a long time, and it's important to recognize that, because now a lot of people that are learning about Palestinian liberation and its history will look back at the PLO and its efforts, will look back at the Palestinian Liberation Front, or look back at PFLP, DFLP, and its leadership that was Western-aligned, or even aligned during the Cold War with the USSR at certain points, and say, oh, why can't they have guys like this? Why do they have scary fundamentalist Muslims, which Hamas is always often portrayed as, and so is Hezbollah, and so are the Houthis. And regardless of their religious perspective, obviously, they still are comprised of very well-read individuals who are rational actors in this process. They're not operating off of like this unrestrained anti-Semitism. That is just a lie that the United States has told, the State Department has told over and over again. That is a lie that is trafficked through all forms of media, through the permissible ways of talking about Palestinian liberation. That's just a way to tarnish a justifiable demand for emancipation from Palestinians.
I mean, you know, it's also, if you study or research the history of some of the key figures that were responsible for October 7th, or, you know, that have emerged over the course of these past 19 months as figures that the world knows about. You look at Yahya Sinwar, who was born in a refugee camp, and his entire life, you can draw an arc of the escalation of Israel's terror attacks against the Palestinians of Gaza and his political development, his intellectual development, how he came to see what Israel is in the world, why he conceived of the, you know, that he spent 22 years in prison. He became fluent in Hebrew. He studied the enemy in prison. He translated by hand the memoirs of former heads of Shin Bet from Hebrew into Arabic and distributed it and distributed these texts to other Palestinian prisoners, telling them we need to study this. Mohammed Daif, who was widely credited with being the most central figure in the modernization of Al-Qassam brigades as a fighting force capable of doing an operation like October 7th. All of these guys, or when you speak to Hamas officials and you ask them about their family history, all of them have a story that begins as a child witnessing the humiliation or the killing of close family members. And when you start to humanize these people that are demonized in the media, and you actually are about the business of being intellectually honest, and you say, where does a Yahya Sinwar come from? Where does a Mohammed Deif come from? Who is Abu Obeida, the spokesperson for the Al-Qassam Brigades, who's one of the most recognizable voices now in the Arab world when it comes to the situation in Gaza? When you start to understand their history, you're really studying the history of Palestinian resistance, and you're studying the history of a gratuitous, violent enemy that believes in the extermination of those people. And then you start to say, well, let's look at this from a different angle. Let's look at this in a very big sense. What is right and what is wrong here? Are the Palestinians terrorists? Is it terrorism to have grown up in a concentration camp where your family members are systematically killed and humiliated? Is that terrorism? Or is there a deeper discourse that we should be engaged in? And that's how Palestinians have always been portrayed. And the United States and Western journalism has been a major player in promoting lethal myths about the Palestinian people. Again, there's all kinds of debates that can be had, you know, about Hamas, about tactics, about what happened on October 7th.
And that's all. They have had these discussions.
But that's all they want to talk about. But that's all they want to talk about. No one wants to talk about, do the Palestinians have a right to use force to get rid of a Western-backed genocidal colonial apartheid regime? If your answer to that question is no, they don't have that right, you're not a serious person, you're not a student of history, and you're just a propagandist for one of the most heinous crimes we've witnessed in our lifetime.
Yeah. Two things I want to mention here, giving more historical context to this as well. Other friend of the show and also Palestine historian, Zachary Foster, who conducted, I believe, his PhD in Princeton, has written
incredible
extensively
work, yeah,
on the Palestinian militancy, specifically lasering in on Hamas and its tactics and how its tactics have evolved, where he says the violence committed by the Israeli military in Gaza during the first year of the Intifada, where 142 Palestinians were killed and zero Israelis were killed, was the same time that Hamas officially transitioned from a charity organization, because it was an Islamic charity, a Muslim Brotherhood cutout that simply worked in charitable works, and it turned into a militant group. And even then, its tactics were not the ones that Israel recognizes and associates Hamas with. The militant violence was almost entirely still directed towards the members of the military and police forces within Israel. And then after the second Intifada, or before the second Intifada, rather, given the very famous act of terror conducted by a Kahanist terrorist, Baruch Goldstein, that was when the Palestinian resistance, or at least some militant factions within the Palestinian resistance, including Hamas, started changing their tactics to also target civilians. And it's the same standard that exists always in any kind of liberation movement, where the standard of violence is always maintained by the oppressive force here. The colonial entity is what dictates what kind of violence exists as retaliation for the endless amount of violence that it subjects its colonial subjects to. And that is the reason why that standard has evolved over 76, 77 years at this point, and has turned into the final culmination of October 7. But having this conversation, or trying to have an academic conversation around like militant resistance, especially in a setting such as this one, is completely not allowed. Like, this conversation that I'm having, many people do not want me to have. They want to simply say, what you are saying is insane. You are crazy. You're a terrorist. You're offering material support to terror groups, and you should be banned or maybe even criminally punished for this.
The idiocy of the line that this is material support is almost not even worth a response. But what I would say is, if you actually believe in a free press and you want journalists to serve a function of providing the public with information that they can use to make informed decisions, then you want journalists to talk to every possible player in every story that you can. And so, you know, I reject fundamentally the notion that by interviewing people that are designated as enemies, that we're committing some crime. The crime that we're committing is called journalism. And if that's a crime, then let 1,000,000,000 journalists bloom. I mean, it's yeah. We should be speaking to everybody. You know, it's one aspect of Trump that I really do respect, that he is willing to authorize his administration to speak apparently with almost anyone. He directly meets with Abu Muhammad al-Jalani, Ahmad al-Shara, who, you know, State Department designated terrorist, was ISIS, was al-Qaeda. You know, he's talking to Ansar Allah. He's talking to Hamas. That's what a sane, rational country should be doing. We should be favoring diplomacy. We should be trying to not have wars. Now, there's a whole other aspect to Trump where he'll do things like, you know, authorize massive bombings of countries and drone strikes, etc. So, like, let's not pretend that he's, you know, some perfect character here. But the basic instinct of let's talk to people, let's go with that, because I actually think that that is one of the paths to peace in our world. But this accusation of material support because you're talking to people or you're explaining context or you're trying to correct the record is very dangerous, particularly because of what's happening in the United States right now, where there is this attempt to criminalize criticism of Israel and to conflate criticism of Israel or Zionism with anti-Semitism, and to try to make that by fiat the law of the land in the United States, or by law. You know, there's enough Democrats that are down with this program that it becomes very, very dangerous. But at the end of the day, what you try to do with your show, what we try to do with our journalism, is to not bend the knee ever to the powerful on any of these questions. And, you know, we respect our readers enough, as I know you respect your audience enough, to let them make their own decisions. Our job is to talk to anyone that we believe has a story to tell that's relevant to the public interest. And I'm going to continue doing that because I think that that's basic journalism. And I wish that the New York Times was doing it. And I've had friends who work at the New York Times say to me, this just isn't really allowed at the New York Times. You know, we can talk to Hamas, but we're not allowed to really get into, you know, their perspective in that way. And there's a reason people don't want to do that. You know who targets civilians nonstop? Israel. You know who justifies the killing of civilians in the name of killing, you know, some former bureaucrat for Hamas? That's what they're down to now. They're whacking people that were in the civil government of Hamas and then putting out press releases saying they've killed some important commander. And they're willing to kill as many women and children as happen to be in the area. And they specifically are targeting and murdering our colleagues, journalists, and their families, you know, nonstop. So, you know, we want to talk about October 7th. 1,300 people were killed that day. And, you know, you had several hundred of them that were in the military or in security forces. You had multiple Israeli military bases attacked. You had scores of Israeli soldiers taken captive by the Palestinian resistance. And yet to this day, it's still portrayed as Hamas and Islamic Jihad went into Israel and kidnapped a bunch of innocent civilians and murdered 1,300, although sometimes they exaggerate the number, murdered 1,300 innocent civilians. Well, we should be fact-checking that. It's not that there weren't a substantial number of civilians killed out of that number. That's true.
Yes.
I've watched the video. I'm very well aware of the scope of events. But let's not pretend that that operation was not, at its inception, targeting Israeli military bases that are responsible for the siege, the blockade, the surveillance, the mowing of the lawn, the bombing of Gaza. Let's have an honest debate about that. Let's not shy away from it and just defer to the narrative because we're afraid of being called pro this or pro that. We have to have an honest discussion about it. And yes, it includes video of the clear intentional killing of civilians. That is absolutely part of this story.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and if we had a real international criminal court that was willing to actually go after war criminals, regardless of their status or power or nationality, then we could have an actual discussion, not just about the events of October 7th and about the role of armed resistance and what happens when civilians are killed in those kinds of operations, but also let's talk about the genocide. Let's talk about what Israel did. Let's talk about the minimum 60,000 people, probably far greater than that, that have been killed. And let's talk about a country that openly, gleefully dehumanizes Palestinians, starves them, and portrays Palestinian children as terrorists ready to grow up.
Or 77 years of an apartheid structure. Sorry to cut you off. 77 years of an apartheid, which is also illegal. I mean, that is... And it's taken many different violent forms because the maintenance of an apartheid is already an inherently violent endeavor. Especially liberals in the West like have no way of defining violence as anything outside of non-state entities, where the permanent violence that people are subjected to by supposedly legal entities is always seen as something entirely different. And the resistance against said violence is actually seen as criminal, is seen as inappropriate, is seen as completely unjustifiable because the state de facto has a monopoly of violence. And in this circumstance, Israel gets to use its own legal structure to continue to continue enforcing this cruel regime upon the indigenous population of Palestinians. I don't know how much more time you have. I know it's late over there, but this was a...
I have to roll. I love being with you, man, but I got to roll.
I know. This was an incredibly enlightening conversation. Thank you so much, Jeremy, for coming on, as always.
I love your crew, man. You know, every time I've ever been on your program, I get like really nice, kind communications from your crew of people, and it's... You have a special audience, and you know, if people are able to support Dropsite, I mean, first of all, we don't ever put anything behind a paywall, so if you don't have the change in your pocket to support us, it's completely fine. You're not going to like not have access to our content, but it is how we fuel our journalism. And if people aren't super familiar with us, we also put a premium on trying to work with and help develop reporters from on the ground in Gaza, in Lebanon, in Syria, and you know, and elsewhere. And but much gratitude to you, Hassan, and to your whole crew here.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on. Jeremy Scale, everybody. Bye. All right. That was Jeremy Scale of Dropsite News, formerly The Intercept, one of my favorite journalists. I stress this a lot, but it is quite remarkable that a person that I have so much respect for, a person whose journalism and a person whose work has guided my worldview and have been so important throughout at least my adolescent years, I can just frequently have on the broadcast now. It's pretty crazy. But yes, they do fantastic work, and I highly recommend you go and subscribe to Dropsite News. You go to dropsitenews.com/Hassan for 20% off, and yeah, that's it.